Hi, Kirby.
Hi, Sarah.
Welcome to Los Angeles.
Welcome, Glamgelinos.
We hope you stay a while.
Cute. Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Press and go. Just press and go.
That's my motto.
Life's a show when you just press and go.
No, literally, that's our 2024 motto.
Just press and go.
We don't have time for glue. We need to just press and go.
Stop with the glue. Glue is so 2002.
Wow.
We're talking about impress, press on falsies, and press on manicure. The impress press on falsies are these lashes that require zero glue. They have a variety of different styles. I personally am a fan of the natural and also the wispies. I like applying a few just to the corner of my eyes. And honestly, this is faster for me than applying mascara. It is so quick. I gotta also tell you the falsies, one thing I forgot to mention, they're the underlash. It's underneath the lash. So they look super, super realistic. No glue, just press and go.
Speaking of press and go, let's talk about the Impress No Glue Manis that I am obsessed with. If you follow me, you know that I am in my press-on era right now because I do not have time to sit in the chair at the salon like many of you for like 2 hours, and that's fine because thanks to Impress, you can have a super fabulous mani in seconds. You don't have to apply any glue. They come in all different styles, and the Impress manicure has a patented super hold adhesive for up to 7 days.
If you want to try the no glue mani or press-on falsies from Impress that won't damage your nails or lashes, just go to Impress, that's impressbeauty.com/Los Angeles, and then use our code Los Angeles at checkout for 25% off Impress manicure and press-on falsies.
All right, Kirby and I, we love all our guests. We love all our episodes, but we are particularly excited for this guest today. We have been texting each other, like sharing her videos with one another, and we're like, this woman is so brilliant.
So smart.
She is so beautiful.
Truly.
And we've learned so much from you, from your TikTok content. So you really are living up to your hot, smart, rich name. So without further ado, everyone welcome Maggie Sellers to Los Angeles.
Woo! Thank you guys so much for having me. I always feel like so much pressure because I want to perform really well, but you guys make it super inviting. So I'm very excited to be here.
Oh, this is a safe space. And for those of you who are not familiar with Maggie, I'm going to read just a little piece from this glossy article that featured Maggie last year. So you have a really, really cool background. You started in special projects and marketing analytics at a Canadian salad chain. Maggie, are you Canadian?
I am. Yeah, I'm from Toronto.
Oh my God. We love our Canadians.
Honestly, we're a very tight-knit bunch. It's very hard to actually come to the U.S. on a visa. So if you make it, it means you're doing something amazing. So we like to stick together.
Amazing. Okay. So then you became the head of artist development and brand strategy at Electric Feel, which managed musicians like Post Malone and the Black Eyed Peas. What you did specifically was you provided companies access to celebrities in exchange for a piece of equity, which is like so genius. And now you invest in and serve as an advisor to a number of companies, including beauty brands like Nudestix, which we love. And then you provide so much informative content on TikTok for especially young women who I just feel like no one is talking about finance and investing like you are, and you make it so interesting and again so serviceable that we can all walk away from your content being like, I learned something today and I am going to be hot, smart, and rich like Maggie Sellers one day.
Well, I think it's such a fun thing because I fell into creating content really. And I just started noticing, like, I love beauty. I love fashion. I want to celebrate that side of myself. But like, I also don't want people to just feel like they have to buy stuff and that they can go onto a platform like TikTok and actually learn something and get educated and not just feel like, oh, I have to buy another lip gloss or another piece of clothing. And it's kind of like really trying to help people figure out the dichotomy that I faced in my own life. Like, I just didn't want to be known as one thing. And so I really started TikTok with like, I want you to feel like you're coming to dinner with me. And we would talk about everything, beauty, fashion, business, dating, relationships, and have a holistic, grounded conversation, not niche down when niching was kind of everything. So that's like kind of how I got started.
And a lot of our followers actually tagged us in a video of yours about JVN hair and it being sold, which we're going to get into because that I think kind of is what our listeners are truly interested in hearing about. You know, we talked at length about the Amorous bankruptcy last year. We walked through, you know, how much total they were making. It was like $58 million for all of those brands in like a year. It was a very interesting breakdown of that particular business and why, honestly, beauty, biotech, you know, it sounds great and it sounds like it's the next frontier, but maybe it isn't hitting yet. It was truly before its time and maybe Amorous shouldn't have gone into creating all of these other celebrity brands. But before we get into that, you are hot, smart, and rich. And we want to know what is on your hot, smart, and rich face. What's the Maggie Sellers look? Like, what products are you obsessed with?
The products that I'm obsessed with right now, I just got the House Labs foundation, which again goes back to a video I did probably years ago when Lady Gaga first launched on Amazon and it was kind of a flop. And then they reformulated and really re-strategized and went into Sephora. Like, I am now obsessed with the products. The foundation, I think, is such a flawless look. I also, as you know, like, I'm involved in nude sticks. So I always carry around this Hydra Peptide lip butter. I don't know why it's not more viral. I know it's like The Road and the Summer Fridays. This, I love those brands, but this I honestly think rivals it, if not is better. And then they sent me this morning their new blush tint SPF 30, which is actually a shade on lip butter. So love that. My biggest hack is I put Vaseline underneath my eyes after my moisturizer and my sunscreen before I put on foundation just to get rid of the lines because I started noticing getting into my 30s, I was getting those lines. Totally goes away. And then the last thing that I wear every single day that I get asked on TikTok probably at least 5 times a day is my eyelashes, what mascara that I'm using. And it's always Rare Beauty. Love the Rare Beauty mascara.
Oh, wow. Oh. I love that I'm referring to you in third person. What does Maggie Sellers smell like?
Well, ooh, okay. So this is actually something that when I went through my engagement breakup, I decided I really wanted a signature scent, one for the day and one for at night. And it was kind of in like the same time period, I really wanted to start embracing my feminine energy on a personal level. So now my day smell is Burberry Goddess, which was actually recommended to me by a Sephora employee, not through TikTok. And then my night is the Killin. I need to figure out what the actual one is, but it's Killin Good Girl Gone Bad, which feels very in my era of where I'm at right now in my life.
I love that.
I love.
Maggie, you have incredible brows. What's your brow routine?
I will say this. I worked so hard for 10 years in like corporate, startup, entrepreneurial grind that I didn't do any of the feminine stuff that I had really like wanted to and neglected. So I never went to Sephora. I wore the same makeup. Like, I didn't do my eyebrows. I just plucked them. And one of the biggest things that I did, I guess, when I also went through my breakup was I started getting my eyebrows done. And it made the biggest difference to the shape of my face and just like the way that I was presenting myself, my cheekbones. So now I go to Anastasia, I see Misha every 4 weeks and I color them in every day and then put a little bit of the new Make Beauty eyebrow gel on them and I'm obsessed.
It looks incredible.
So for people that may not be familiar with your breakup story, would you mind just sharing the top level dissertation of that and how it kind of helped you evolve into who you are today? I think it's a great story. And I think that people need to hear it.
Yeah, for sure. So I was engaged and I realized, honestly, the biggest thing is I didn't like myself in the relationship. And I was turning into somebody that I felt like I really didn't want to be as a mother figure and as a partner in the relationship. And going back to kind of like my business brain is like, I have really worked like incredibly hard going into the beginning of my career. I was doing investment banking hours at some of the fastest growing direct consumer startup brands. And it was really a masculine energy that was coming out in me. You know, you're around guys all the time, which I am to this day, fighting for allocations and deals. And you become a very specific side of yourself through that experience. And I had really neglected a lot of the things that I think make me an amazing person. That's why I have the same friends from when I was younger. And so I just kind of started to get really curious about what my life would look like. And I felt like it wasn't bringing out the best in me and I wasn't being authentically myself. And so I made a huge decision to completely transform my life. I called off my engagement. I literally put all my stuff into storage. I moved to Calabasas. I horseback rode, you know, 4 days a week. I didn't go on dating apps. I honestly became a hermit and stopped the hustle of LA life of going to events and saying yes to everything and turned inward to really figure out like, who am I and how can I bring value to the world? And my life has just exploded and opportunities like this have come my way because I've really taken a very hard thing at 31. You know, you probably are thinking, you know, I'm in my 30s and they scare you that you're never going to be able to have a baby. And I knew that it wasn't for me and I wasn't being authentically myself. And honestly, now getting through the thick of it, I'm the happiest, healthiest, hottest, richest, smartest version of myself. And I would just challenge anybody that feels like they're not sure to just dig inside themselves and you'll be surprised what you'll do when you continue to bet on yourself.
I love that. It's so important. It really is important. And it takes a lot for somebody to actually put that out for strangers, because I'm sure there was plenty of people that were critical and you get negative comments on TikTok and stuff. But the positivity in the community that you've developed through sharing that, I think probably outweighs any negativity you've probably gotten.
Totally. I mean, I think that's actually something that, you know, I'm experiencing now dating for the first time with a platform of sorts. Like, you know, some men are not super interested in being a part of that as their life unfolding on social media. And I say to them, the reason it's so important for me to talk about is there is so much stuff that happens behind closed doors in the startup industry and specifically in corporate for women of, you know, feeling uncomfortable or making sure that people know that it's like you're there for business. Like you're not a toy piece that, you know, is there just to look pretty. And there's a lot of stuff that's happened to me in my career that I have felt very silenced by. And I think it's really important that women have somebody that they can turn to talk about the trials and tribulations of what it's like being in the work and startup environment, and then what it's like dating in that and all of the mixed signs. Like, does he like me or does he want to do business with me? Is he asking for a dinner meeting because he's interested? Okay, he's married. Like, well, how do I make sure that if we're developing a work relationship that his partner feels really comfortable with me, that she may think of me as a threat? And so it is extremely important to me to continue to talk about what is the entire woman experience and being very holistic with that. And I think that's been a huge change since calling off my engagement. It went from, if you look back, just business. That's all I talked about, like with the odd beauty, makeup, you know, dinner party conversation. And now it's very equal. It's like there's one about beauty, then one about dating, then one about business, then one about this. And I need to find somebody that appreciates and respects that, because the mission of what it is so much bigger than just wanting to air my dirty laundry out onto the internet, if that makes sense.
Totally.
I love that. Okay, Maggie. So as I mentioned, you invest in advice for a lot of beauty brands and you talk a lot about like what makes a brand successful and profitable or not on your TikTok. What are some brands you think are doing really well right now that might not be on other people's radar? Like, who do you think is doing something exciting? And like, who excites you right now?
Yeah. I wrote down four brands that are all doing different things because I think it's really important in beauty. It's evolving so much. And I really tried to focus on consumer brands. Obviously, I do a lot of CPG or tech investments as well. But for this purpose, I want to start with standard procedure for sunscreen. So it's actually an Australian made sunscreen brand. You probably haven't heard of them, but they really have the cleanest ingredients. And I think that they've done an incredible job being such a small female founded startup, having already collaborated with Zara. And I believe their collaboration with Zara was one of the first that Zara didn't actually like take over the packaging. It was just sold as like a standard procedure bottle in the Zara stores. I think what she's doing for sunscreen is going to be really impactful. And I don't think we've seen a huge entrance into the market from Supergoop. So I think standard procedure is one that's definitely on my radar. I think Array, you know, most people wouldn't think of supplements as beauty, but I really do think the future of beauty is beauty from within. And I think it's also beauty from like a longevity standpoint. A lot of what I just went viral for is the health changes that I've made. And that's why my skin is so clear right now. That's how I've healed my hormonal acne. So I want to really call it Array because I truly think they have the best efficacy in terms of products and the way that they launch. They're not doing so many launches. And that's a really key learning that I've had. You know, you look at brands that launch with like 40 SKUs. How could you ever do 40 SKUs really well? Array has been around for years, and I think they only just launched their third or maybe fourth SKU. And I really do believe supplements are a huge part of a beauty routine. I also shockingly love, because I'm not a huge fan of incubated celebrity or incubated brands from an incubation house. I really tend to not like those types of companies, but I love the products of Make Beauty. I hadn't heard of them. They sent me a bunch of products. So this under eye concealer that I think is incredible. I love their packaging. I actually was extremely impressed with the product efficacy. So I have to shout them out because I think they were incredible. And then I think Mara is another brand that I've recently, you know, been paying a ton of attention to. I love how everything's made from algae. Allison has such an incredible story. I went to their recent launch of their first face cream, and just every single detail and the way that she curated the environment was so authentic to her as a founder. And again, she's not growing super fast. She's doing things for the consumer and taking them along. So I think those are the four that are not mainstream yet that are catching my attention and I think are doing things that are really different and unique.
I love that. You touched on incubators. Can you, for our listeners, explain the difference between like an incubator versus like any other beauty company?
So in the most simple way to explain it is an incubator would be a group of people, probably experienced operators or a corporation, where they want to pump out multiple brands that have a differentiated approach, but that will share services and will have scalability. Because let's say there's a beauty incubator, they can have five different facing retail brands to the consumer, but then they will share services like HR, finance, accounting, maybe R&D, product development. And so there's a lot of benefits in terms of like unit economics and economies of scale for the incubation house. And it's also like what we do in investing, right? You invest in a portfolio. It's why they say to have a diversified portfolio, because you're probably not going to hit a home run on every single one. But there's a high likelihood that if you, you know, diversify your basket and you have multiple eggs, one of them will hatch and it's going to be super successful. So that's kind of the same way that incubation houses think about the brands that they're launching, where maybe not all of them will be super successful, but they really will hedge their bet and create multiple retail brands from the same incubation house. But to the consumer, most times they have zero idea. So really, one is from a very big founder fit perspective, where it's like they experience the pain point. They kind of, it's their sole focus. They're really focused on bringing that to market, like an Allison from Mara. And then the typical, what we've seen over the last little while, is this kind of holding company incubation model, which I'm sure we'll touch on with Amaris, that again is operating multiple brands out of the same incubation house.
And you said that you typically don't like the incubation houses. Is it because you feel that they don't have like a clear point of view on what the brand is that they're bringing to life? Like it feels a little less authentic and that they're just trying to fit puzzle pieces together?
I think, yeah. And I mean, listen, like one of the things that's so hard about putting out a statement, like I hate incubation houses, is there are some that are done really well. And yeah, it's not a distaste for it. I think for me, I'm such a builder and I love to build things. And I think what I've seen with the incubation model is that sometimes, and again, I'm really jaded in a lot of ways, because once you're in the industry for as long as I've been, and you've seen a lot of the sides, you know, I've been a startup operator, I've been on the entertainment side, actually representing talent, doing their deals. And then I've actually been the one that have negotiated the deals and actually placed celebrities into brands. So I've seen a lot, and I'm also an investor in a lot of celebrity brands. So I've really seen all four areas or access points. And the way that the deals are structured in an incubation house, if there's a celebrity attached, is very different than the way that, for example, Hailey Bieber launched Rode, which was like from her own volition, you know, being in control and really having, like, she has a lot on the line to lose if Rode doesn't do well, where typically celebrities that are part of an incubation house, like if it doesn't do well, it's kind of swept under the rug. Like there's nothing that they're really losing. It really won't even catch in the mainstream media. They have really no money at risk. And so it's just like kind of on to the next. And not that I think people need to be held accountable, because failure is a huge part of building a business. And I've failed so many times, and I continue and will continue to fail. It's, I think the way that the deals are structured feels like, as the person that would be putting in money as the investor into it, I don't have people that will do anything to make it work, because there's a way out for them. There's another brand that they can build. There's another thing that they can go and do in their career. And they don't actually have that much on the line. Typically, investors want founders that have a lot to lose, and they will do anything to make their business succeed because they have a fiduciary duty to us to steward our capital. Does that make sense?
So you're saying that some of these celebrities that are part of these incubation houses, they have less to lose. They're not on the line. They don't have their, you know, fiduciary duty.
Yeah.
The tongue twister. Is that why we see the celebrity brands that are performing well are the ones where the celebrity is literally out there doing tutorials, going to the Sephoras, going to the Ultas, like really trying consistently to drum up conversation about their brand? Like Rihanna was really like the first in the last 10 years to step out on a limb and do this, and obviously had a great point of differentiation with her brand. We see that with Selena. We see that with Hailey, obviously. But then there's other celebrity brand founders that are not as actively engaged with their consumer. Do you think that there's a correlation between like how much effort they're putting into the social of it all with like how much they have to lose?
Yeah, 1,000%. I mean, I think like it's that, it's the piece of actually engaging with the community and wanting to do this. And there's a lot of lessons that I've learned structuring these deals. Like it's also about the life cycle of the celebrity. And one of the biggest kind of like hot takes that I have is if somebody were to offer me and be like, hey, go be the co-founder of a celebrity founded beauty brand, I'd be like, okay, but I want a creator founder. I actually don't want a celebrity, a traditional celebrity, because creators were born to create content and they are born to nurture and curate their community. And traditional celebrities, let's say a musician or an actor or even a model, like they are focused on other initiatives as their number one priority. Tour will always take precedent. A movie shoot will always take precedent. And so their brand becomes second nature to them, or not second nature, it could become second priority. And that's never a good thing when you're trying to build a $1 billion company. And so I think there's definitely the correlation between how engaged and how actually involved they are. But I also think it goes a lot. And the most important thing I've learned being on the investor side is this is about control. And control is something that people don't understand. When you own 100% of your business, you're bootstrapped. You have control over every decision that you make. When you start taking excise outside capital, you start losing control. And the amount of control that you'll lose will differ. But what I love love about Haley and Rode, and again, I'm not an investor in that business. I don't personally have any relationship with them. So this is just stuff I've learned from what's available online. But she really has control of the business. She's on the board. That's huge. That means that she's making actual voting decisions in terms of where the company is evolving to. She doesn't just sit in social, in creative world, which a lot of the time celebrities only touch, if it's especially from an incubation brand, they have no idea what's going on across finance, across operations, across HR, sometimes even R&D, even marketing. All they're doing is showing up, hitting their deliverables, and then waiting for whether it's a check from their minimum guarantee, or they have equity, or they're doing, you know, store visits. They don't have any visibility over to the rest of the company. And that's always a huge red flag for me when I get a pitch for a celebrity-founded brand. It's like, how involved is this celebrity, not just from their deliverables to the community, but what is their involvement with the growth of the actual organization? Because if it's limited, that's a huge red flag to me that this is just another celebrity brand that is going to slap their face on it. And don't get me wrong, they might get to $10, $20, $30 million of sales. It's very different to get to $100 million of sales. And I honestly would argue that I don't know if you need a celebrity to do that. Like we saw with Hero Cosmetics, they didn't have a celebrity co-founder. It's definitely a growth lever, and it's something that can be leveraged if you need it, if you want it, and it's done in the right way. But it's not necessary to build a really amazing brand in the beauty industry, in my opinion. I actually think it's like overdone now.
Yeah. And I think there's something else in your specific video that you did about Rode and Haley that you mentioned too, that Kirby and I talk a lot about, is, well, you call it Easter egg credibility, where like Haley has been talking about beauty like long before she launched her own brand. And that is something that Kirby and I feel like always talk about. We're like, when we hear about a celebrity launching a skincare brand, let's say, we're like, has this person ever spoken about skincare in their life before this moment? Does this person know how to apply the makeup products that they're trying to sell? You know what I mean? So can you talk a little bit about like why you admire Haley from that aspect?
And what is Easter egg credibility?
And yeah, what is Easter egg credibility?
Yeah. Easter egg credibility is something I termed because I felt like if you're smart and you have a good team around you, they'll help you do this. Like Pamela Anderson, I would argue, we kind of just saw do this too, where for a year before she's not wearing makeup on red carpets, she's posting on social media, not wearing makeup. And then lo and behold, oh my God, no way. What she's involved in has to do with not wearing makeup. Like that is Easter egg credibility. And Easter egg is these like little secret hunts that you go on. You're leaving little trail marks to the consumer around your interests, you know, what you're passionate about. And it's almost like taking your consumer and community along the journey of you building it even before it's announced. And I thought Haley did such a good job of like paving that credibility. I still remember her from the Barbara Sturm days, and I forget what it's called. We both have it. It's like perioral dermatitis, and it's like it shows up like pimples.
Yeah, perioral derm.
Yeah, she talked about that. And I remember watching a video with her and Barbara Sturm on that. And immediately, because I had experienced the same condition, I associated Haley with the same credential that the doctor Barbara Sturm has, which for better or for worse is obviously not the same. But I think just by her doing things like that and being so front-facing with these brands, it was like a no wonder she's coming out with her own skincare brand. Of course she should. This is something she's been passionate about, excited about, learned about. You know, we all didn't know when we were 18 years old that we wanted to be in skincare and be a dermatologist and, you know, have the grades to go to medical school. And I think it would be unfair to assume that the only people that have the right to launch something in that space are the subject matter experts or the trade experts. So I think if you have a passion that you've developed later on in life and maybe you don't want to go back to school, and you can partner with somebody that has that credibility and that can give you the science and like the efficacy for it, you should then spend your time like you guys are doing, being experts in this space so that you actually are trusted by your community, that when you come out with something, it makes sense. And, you know, I can tell you from being on the celebrity side, there are stories that I have where I've worked with celebrities that have 7, 8, 9 million followers. We'll do a deal and they will sell like a really shockingly low amount of product because their audience doesn't trust them in that category. But then we'll do a deal with another category and they will absolutely blow through sales. So it's about like, what does the community go to you for? And it has to be over a long period of time, which again is like that Easter egg credibility, so that once you actually do something in that category, it makes sense to the consumer and you're not trying to convince them to trust you. They already just inherently have it.
I have to ask, we have to talk about Beyonce and Sacred and what your thoughts are on this launch, because obviously she is Beyonce and I truly believe that she, you know, can sell whatever the hell she wants. She has such a strong fan base that they are going to buy it. But what are your thoughts from like, I mean, you have so much experience, you've seen it all. Oh, and this also ties to what Kirby was talking about. We don't know that Beyonce is ever going to do her own hair tutorial for social. We don't think she's going to connect with her consumers like that. Does she need to sell hair products?
So I would be lying if I gave like a, this is exactly what I think, because I haven't looked into it enough, to be honest. And I think that's one of the biggest like lessons that I've had around, there's so much that's happening in the world of brands that to keep up with everything is impossible. And so like, I would need to go and do like a full, I saw pieces of the launch and like, you know, wear white to the party and whatever. It's all great as of now. And yes, to your point, Sarah, like Beyonce will sell through an initial PO or she'll sell through the initial launch. But the biggest test is what's the reorder rate? Like, is there a ton of people on subscription? Are the retailers placing POs? Like, I'm assuming with the name as big as Beyonce, she's going to be able to launch with like one of the national retailers. But like, let's see when there's an initial launch, what the actual reorder strategy is like, because that's the biggest test, where I have no doubt she'll sell through whatever millions she'll do on the first, you know, year of sales. But how many people are signing up for a subscription? How many people are repeat purchasers? Like, how many products are they dropping at one time? And then how consistently are they bringing new SKUs in? Similarly, like LeBron just announced that he's doing a skincare brand with a national launch, I believe in Walmart. Don't quote me on that.
Sarah's like, oh my God, what? She loves LeBron.
We're going to get LeBron on the pod then. Stan. Great.
Yeah. So he announced that. I put that in my newsletter last week. And I think the same kind of, I guess, verbiage that I'm saying about Beyonce, I would say towards LeBron. Like, it really depends on the products and what his focus is going to be. He will get the attention. He will be able to launch at Walmart, but let's see which ones actually have longevity, because if they're not involved in this, it's not their priority and it's just an incubator trying to push product. It might work for the first year, but it might not work after that.
Totally.
And they don't always care or want longevity, right? Like, that's not always the goal for people.
I think the goal, I mean, listen, having convinced celebrities to do deals, like the goal is definitely to sell. Everybody thinks that they're going to be the next Kanye, Jay-Z, Rihanna, building billion-dollar empires off of their brands. Why I actually respect Taylor Swift so much is like, she's, I think, one of the only entertainers that has become a billionaire off of her craft, which is music. And I actually have so much respect for her that she hasn't launched a brand yet, TBD on when and if she does. But I think every celebrity, you know, their team is like, this is the next billion-dollar idea. We can sell X amount of units. So they don't want to launch things just to like launch it and it go nowhere. They are launching things for a sale. That's why you take equity in things, is like you have ownership and that you're expecting that the cash that you could get today from a company like a L'Oreal or Estee Lauder is going to be less than the equity ownership amount that you will have as a future sale when your company gets acquired by an Estee Lauder or a L'Oreal. So they do want that longevity. I just don't know if people think through the 5-10 year plan like they should, in terms of how are we actually going to get there though?
I was going to say, I wanted to go back to Beyonce and Sacred for a minute, because I was just looking up what her net worth is. And there's actually like recent relevant stories about whether Beyonce will become a billionaire this year and join Rihanna. But what is the benefit of Beyonce launching a brand? I mean, she's already so successful just at her craft. Obviously, she did stuff with Ivy Park and now she's launching Sacred. And she has such a great community. So maybe it's dumb to not launch something, but it feels like a lot of work for someone who very much values her privacy and not keeping everybody kind of at arm's length. It's like, you see what I want you to see. I speak to you when I want to speak to you. If you want to see me come to a concert, it's not the same tactic as all these other celebrity beauty brands. And I think, Maggie, you probably saw this too on social, but at the launch party, I mean, I was like, so we get Getty images and then these flash in the pan videos where it looks like people are literally sneaking videos of her. It is like the most bizarre thing. And I asked what happened. I said, who was at this event and why weren't y'all like taking photos and videos with her? And they were like, there were no photo ops with her. And they asked us not to film her speaking. That's why you're seeing like somebody holding a phone like at their navel, like trying to get like one solitary 3-second video of Beyonce interacting and shaking people's hands. But what is the value for Beyonce to launch a brand, like in your point of view, since you have this like whole 360 comprehension of this, what's the value for her launching this? Is it just strictly money? Is it connecting to the community? Is it becoming more relatable since she's so aspirational?
That's a really great question. And I think it's situational based on the celebrity and their team. And again, I have a lot of respect for Beyonce and especially Jay-Z. I think Jay-Z is one of like the most incredible business minds from the music industry that I've actually ever seen. He was a true, true pioneer. So let's not forget that that's her partner in life. I think that if I'm being totally honest, like ego drives a lot of decisions. Once you have money and you don't have to worry about things, what is the most, and this is why we always see like the tech bros, right? Like they start descending down onto Hollywood scenes. They're dating and marrying models. They're, you know, going to parties with the, you know, the Kardashians, because what is unattainable for a lot of people is that, what's the right word? It's like the exclusivity of Hollywood and like the legacy that you can leave. And I think a lot of the time ego does drive a lot of decisions, because once you have so much money, it's like, how much more do you really need, right? But I think legacies are something that people think about leaving behind. Like Estee Lauder was a real woman, you know, like people know who that is. She is a name that will go down in history. And it's something that I think drives a lot of decisions that we don't talk about, because you're right. It's like, when is enough, right? I do think having peeled back the layer of being a part and knowing and being and working on the teams of this, like there is something very scary about being forgotten as a celebrity. There is something very scary about relevancy. And we just saw this. I loved when Wiz Khalifa went on the podcast with Call Her Daddy, because Wiz Khalifa is also like a super amazing icon. And he was really one of the best rappers. And, you know, he's come in and out in terms of like his relevancy. And he talks about this with Alex. And he's just like, one of the scariest things when you go from being at every single fashion show, every single award show, you are invited on every podcast and TV spot. And then all of a sudden, nobody's calling you. Your agent can't get you into the fashion show. You know, it is a very addictive substance, fame. And I think that you're always trying to seek relevancy, right? And I think right now, consumers, we used to idolize the celebrities that were on Us Weekly. And now we start to turn our attention to people and creators like Alex Earle or Alex Cooper, who show so much of their life. And I think that celebrities, I don't think it's to be relatable, because traditional celebrities don't want to be relatable. But I think that having a brand gives them that point to create a legacy, to try and engage with their community in a different way without necessarily having to show their life like our creators, our favorite creators do. But yeah, being on the inside kind of secret channel of celebrities, I guess, I would just say, like, you know, fame is a very addictive thing. And it's hard when you become almost irrelevant. And I think that brands is a way to try to salvage relevancy. Not that I don't think Beyonce is relevant, but I think it's just interesting to think about why she would do it outside of the financial reasons.
Like to have a legacy outside of her musical legacy and her contributions to music.
And I think, too, it's like, you know, Jay-Z, Kanye, and Rihanna are the three that are mentioned all the time who really pioneered celebrity brands. Although celebrity brands have been around for long before them. But from this era, they're really like the pioneers of that. And Beyonce is not there, right? Like she doesn't have, like Ivy Park, I don't think was as successful as those other brands. So I think that, you know, Beyonce is a leader. She's a pioneer in what she's done in the music side. And I think she probably also wants to be a pioneer and leader in the brand side and be amongst the names of her husband, of Kanye, of Rihanna. And, you know, this is her chance to do that.
Someone was like, did Beyonce specifically choose to launch Sacred on Rihanna's birthday? And
oh,
I was like,
my God.
No.
Be for real.
I don't. Yeah.
Be for real.
I think that was probably the one day that Beyonce was available to like, be at this party for an hour, and that's why she chose that day. But continue to sip tea.
I actually think that this brand is Tina Knowles's brand. I think that this brand is 100% Miss Tina doing all of it, like putting it together. Beyonce's the face of it and is going to take it to the level it needs to be for optics and obviously getting the Beehive involved. But I mean, she even says part of the story for Sacred is her mom working in the salon and her going to the salon, her mom doing her hair throughout her entire musical career. And so I think that's why we're seeing a lot more of, for press at least this past week, you're seeing interviews with Tina mm-hmm. versus Beyonce on camera. And like they probably got some quotes from Beyonce through like email interview and stuff like that. And then she obviously did the big Essence covers to help drive awareness of the brand. But I'm really interested to see where Sacred goes and how Beyonce interacts or doesn't interact with it. But we need to talk about Amorous. Please, we got to talk about Amorous. We have to talk about JVN. So we're going to link this video in our show notes, everybody, so that you guys can go watch it. This is what got Sarah and I, like it scratched an itch for us because we were talking about just how disastrous this bankruptcy was. And when we were going through all of the different brands, Rosie Huntington-Whiteley was basically the face of this bankruptcy, which was very interesting. If you read any of the stories, it wasn't JVN's face or Naomi Watts's face. It was Rosie being the main image for all of it. And when they mentioned the brands, Rose Inc. was always the first one outside of Biossance. So we had JVN on the podcast when the brand launched, and we love his products. We think, and we know that you do too. The brand makes some really great hair products. But how could a seemingly successful brand with such potential only sell for $2.5 million?
No, 1.25.
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry. 1.25 million. And just to give everybody a primer, Amorous went bankrupt and then JVN was the first brand to sell off. Is that right, Maggie?
I think so. Yeah, because they went to bankruptcy court very close to each other. But yeah, I'm pretty sure it was the first one.
Okay, so how do we get here? Because wasn't it valued at 12.5 million or it made 12.5 million? Or can you walk us through that?
Yeah. So what I talk about in the video is like, again, with privately held companies, there's not that much information that you get from a financial perspective, which is why it's typically such a risky asset class to invest in, because you're really just taking the information that the founder is giving you and then doing your due diligence to better understand the space. So there's actually no way, unless you were to read through all the bankruptcy documents, which in full transparency, I haven't done, but I have specific software that you'll see in the video, which really like talks about and monthly average viewers that go to the website of JVN Hair. And I was actually really shocked by it because it was significantly higher. Most beauty is actually sold predominantly through the major distributors. So like a Sephora or an Ulta, or if it's more of like a mass prestige, like a Target or a Walmart. So I was really impressed with the amount of monthly visitors that they have to their website. And then if we take the average conversion that you see to actually go to path to purchase for an e-commerce brand, which is 2%. I don't want to get the numbers wrong because it's in the video, but like they were doing, I think conservatively, like 3 million top line for a yearly annualized revenue. And then that's not including their Sephora business, which I was also using a lot of personal experiences. The reason I even knew about, to be honest, I don't really watch TV. So I didn't know who JVN was as a person. I went into Sephora like a year and a half ago and I had just started doing these slick back buns that I'm wearing right now. and I asked, you know, I can't get the grease out of my hair. What is the best shampoo that will like actually clean my hair after days of slick back buns? And the woman recommended JVN Hair and the clarifying shampoo. And I still had no clue that it was JVN's brand. Love the products. So this was also like experiences that I've had to be like, okay, you know, it's at a distributor that's recommending this. So they have really great salespeople that are pushing this product, which means that it's not just sitting empty on shelves in Sephora. So the fact of the matter is like they have great distribution. They have great products. They're getting this amount of traffic to their website every single month. And if you combine some assumptions that I do in the video, let's say conservatively, they're doing $7 million top line. We, unfortunately, with a privately held brand, won't see what I talked about earlier with like repeat purchases, like people on subscription. That's all information that's not accessible. So there's a lot of information we don't know. Two really important numbers when you're analyzing a company is like customer acquisition cost and the LTV. So how much are they paying to acquire a customer? Because it's one thing if you're doing $7 million top line, but you're paying and you're losing money on each of the initial customers that you're bringing in the door. And then the LTV, the lifetime value, will tell you how much are these consumers coming back to purchase. So you never want your customer acquisition cost to be more than your lifetime value of your customer, because it means that you're paying to acquire a customer more than they're ever going to give you back to your brand. So we don't know any of this stuff, right? So the point of the video was more so just like, something is weird with the way that this deal was structured, because it goes back to what I said earlier around control. We don't know if JVN's team, you know, thought to have the stalking horse bidder, which means that like you're given a preferential treatment in the way that the brand is going to auction and the control over like how you actually bid for the brand at auction. We don't know if JVN's team was offered that. But what it said to me more than anything is like the way that the deal was structured from the get-go, way before the bankruptcy even happened, to me was slapping a face onto a brand, having zero control. And that's how we got here, because we don't know so much about how it's evolved. And you'll see in the video, like Amaris is the person with all of the debt and limited cash on hand, not JVN. That was a huge misconception from the video that I put up, that people were like, oh my God, they have, I forget what it was, like $1 billion of debt at JVN. No, Amaris has $1 billion of debt and only $11 million of cash on hand. So they don't have a way to repay their debt. But the moral of this video was like, this is a failure only because how did it get to this point? It was the way it was structured. And it's the tale as old as time, you know, from the Amaris side, shiny object syndrome. People don't know that Amaris actually started in 2003 as an anti-malaria drug. And then it actually became the world's most sustainable biotech ingredient sourcing company with a specialization in squalene, which is then how they launched Biossance, which was an incredibly successful brand. And then it's like celebrity brand explosion. You know, we're doing Rose Inc., we're doing JVN, we're doing, I think they had 12 other brands aside from those main three, back to the incubation model. You don't have enough working capital to be able to operate all of those brands. And if the celebrity who is basically giving the right to their name and likeness to be able to be used in whatever way and then has zero control, that's really scary. That's what you don't want if you're on a celebrity team. You need to be able to have and make sure that you have control so that Rosie wasn't the face of this, because this actually wasn't a Rosie problem. This was an Amaris problem. And she's the catalyst to that. And same with JVN. And it's just like, it's kind of sad to see.
You compared JVN's brand to Ariana Grande's REM. Can you explain your thoughts on that?
Can you explain this to me? Maybe this is what you've already been saying, but I'm like, I don't understand it. Are you saying that the deal basically was set up so that JVN could not have bought back his brand the way that Ariana bought REM Beauty out of bankruptcy?
So I wouldn't know that. I wouldn't know how the deal was set up to be able to say if he was given a first right of refusal. Like, there was something that Wingsong Global that actually got the business in bankruptcy. They were given what's called like a stalking horse bidder, which is again, like the first person to make the bid. And then after due diligence, they can actually like run through how the process is going to go. I don't know if JVN's team was given that option. So that's not something that we would know. But with Ariana Grande, very similar. Like, it was structured initially out of an incubation house. I believe it's called Former Brands. So when they went bankrupt, Ariana Grande, what I loved about this from the research that we know, because again, this is all private market company information. This is not publicly accessible. So what we know from the press, which take with a grain of salt, is that she actually made a bid and she bought her brand back, which I believe was valued at $15 million. Then once she actually owned it as Ariana Grande, she then went to go refinance it with, I believe, Sandbridge Capital, which is a really, really, really reputable venture fund. So she wasn't just putting out $15 million and then is like, now just the sole owner. She's actually then going and refinancing that, which is exactly what you do in Chapter 11 bankruptcy. You're basically buying a company to restructure its debt. You're given a second chance. Like, a lot of the times you're forgiven from your creditors, which is crazy. And so you're given a second chance. The second chance is that she, as the owner, is like, I'm going to go and refinance this now, which doesn't mean to say, that's what I was kind of saying with the JVN thing. Like, yeah, he could have put out $1.5 million initially if he was given that option, which we don't know. And then he could have gone and refinanced that debt to a Sandbridge Capital or to another venture fund. So those are the things we don't know. But what I respect about Ariana Grande is she was so focused, I believe, on her reputation and on like, no, this is something I'm actually passionate about. I'm going to put skin in the game. I'm going to make a statement. I'm going to acquire the rights for REM. I'm going to take it back in-house. And then she still went to go refinance it with Sandbridge and bring proper institutional investors in, not dissimilar to how Rode was structured, right? Haley put up the bulk of the capital, from my knowledge, at the beginning with her business partner, I believe Michael Ratner. And then she went out and I believe it's called One Luxury Group. That's like the majority finance partner that they went to. So she does have external investors, similarly to how Ariana Grande does with Sandbridge Capital and REM. But the way that they have control of the business is it's directly from those celebrities and not from those incubation houses. Does that make sense?
Totally. Yep.
Yes. Yes.
And that's why we can't blame JVN for not acquiring his brand back, because we don't know if he had even the option to do so based on the structure of that deal.
Yeah, 100%. And like, that's what I was more so getting at with the video, is just the way that the deal was structured in the beginning is making sure that JVN's team is like super aware of how, and again, like, I have so much respect. I don't know everything. I just was shocked seeing the way that it went down, because in my head, you know, I'm like, how does this, there's got to be something that we don't know, which is why I try to approach every video asking for feedback. Like, I multiple times said, I don't know everything. Like, I must be missing something, because this is so weird that there's got to be something that somebody else knows that's way smarter and more qualified than I am. And I think that's what, you know, going back to like kind of my TikTok, is I am here to learn and I'm here to take people on my journey and what I've seen by being as transparent as possible. But something was really weird about that deal, because it's very different from what we've seen with other celebrity brands. And it happened both with Rosie and JVN. Neither of them bought their brands back. So to me, that signals like there was something as the way they were structured initially that almost like maybe didn't allow them to. And again, goes back to why I'm not a huge incubation fan, because of this reason exactly. Like, there's just so much that's out of your control.
Totally. I am friends with someone who is on like the executive team of JVN Hair, and I asked how they were doing, and she was like, we're doing amazing. So like, like, that's great to hear. I'm very curious to see like what the next year looks like for them. But thank you, Maggie, for breaking that down for us, because we were
of course.
There's just so many questions. We have to ask you before you go, the five things you would never do as a hot, smart, rich woman. What are those things, Maggie?
Five things I would never do. I would never any longer chase I'm only attracting in my personal life, but in business, you can both chase and attract. I'm like a big believer that in business, you have to go after what you want and like you have to be direct and you have to just like be very like relentless in rejection. But in my personal life, I definitely do not chase any longer. I think the second biggest thing, and I write this down on my paper every single morning, especially having a platform of sorts now, is I don't listen to nor create for my critics. Like I can only do my best. And if I listen to the people that have assumptions about me or, you know, call me whatever they want to call me, you know, I've been ripped apart a lot over the last year and thank God I'm 31 because I can handle it now. But I don't create for those people. I create for the people that feel lost in their career, feel lost in their relationship, feel like they want to continue to learn. That's who I'm creating for. I would never not wear sunscreen. I think that is like the most important thing in a beauty routine, 1000%. I also would never overspend or think that a new product will solve problems. I think that if you can't pay off your credit card bill every single month in full and not accumulate interest, like that is a huge concern and you need to figure out the trigger of what's causing you to like just spend out of control or figure out a way to better balance your finances because a credit card is a beautiful thing, but it can be abused. So I would definitely make sure you can always pay it off. And then the last thing is like, I would never not be myself anymore. I think I've silenced myself and pretended to be this like very one-dimensional human in the past. And being this like multi-hyphenate creative that explores and talks about and loves all these different aspects of my life is what makes me Maggie. And it has really positioned me in this new kind of era in my career. So I would say to anybody that feels like they're hiding their authentic self, that's the most powerful thing about you. And just try to embrace all sides of it, even if people don't necessarily want to see all of it. It's really beautiful when you kind of just express and embrace who you are as a full human.
Amazing. Maggie, thank you so much for joining us on Los Angeles. Where can everybody find you online so they can get more of your great advice?
You can find me at Maggie Sellers on Instagram and then at Maggie Sellers _ on TikTok. So I hope to see you there.
All right, that's it. Thank you everyone for listening. We will be back on Tuesday with the week's most buzzy beauty news.
Make sure you subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and follow us on Spotify so you don't miss any breaking beauty news or product reviews. And if you want to support us, be sure to follow us at Los Angeles Pod on all platforms and join our Facebook group.
Plus, find every product we recommend on our website, losangelespod.com, as well as links to the stories and news we report each week. You can follow us, your hosts. I'm Sarah Tan, that's SARATAN, on all social platforms.
And I'm Kirby Johnson, KIRBIE, on all social platforms.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.